Welcome to Turning Pages, a series of in-depth conversations with authors about their works.
All right, well, her latest novel is called The Morning Bell Brings the Brokenhearted. Jennifer Manuel joins me on the show to discuss it. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
My pleasure. Now, I have to admit, I looked up to walk in because I was curious if it was a real place and discovered that it's a place that you set your first novel in and have returned to. And I'm curious if, having not read that first novel, was this like a natural extension of that first novel, or was it there like a portion of the story you had yet to tell and decided to go back to this community?
Well, first of all, this second novel, while it's set in the same community, is set 5 years prior to the first novel. So there are characters that appear in both. Mm-hmm. One of the main characters in The Morning Bell Brings the Brokenhearted, was a teenager in the first book. So there's overlap there. In terms of an extension of the story, they're really standalone, and there are very two different stories. This one is the one closer to my experience and my concerns for Indigenous education.
Right, because I was going to say you yourself have been an educator in Indigenous communities, and the central character, Molly Royston, is an educator. How much of your own experience did you draw on for her, or for the like experience of, you know, showing what education system is like in a community like this?
Well, I think in this one, there's a lot of fantastical things that happen, almost a magic realism approach at times. So those aspects do not pertain to any of my experiences. However, I would say that the overall types of characters, whether they be children or the adults in the books, are very, very much aligned with my experience, including the fact that you often encounter some very unusual characters in real life when you go to very remote settings. And I don't mean the people living there, but the people who go to work there.
Yeah. At one point you have a coworker, Joan, say, you know, are you a runner, a user, or a saver? That, like, essentially she divides the people into three types who come into these communities and why they've landed in those communities. Is that something that you had kind of ascertained yourself being in these communities?
Yes. Early on in my career, it occurred to me one day, this concept of users, runners, and savers. And interestingly, that is the point, because that mention of users, runners, and savers also appeared in the first book. And the few people that have had real contention with something I've written have been non-First Nations people who did not like those categories and felt that they, their work that they did, place them outside of those three categories, and that's fine that they believe that. I stand firm to those three categories.
So the resistance was after the first book, because you'd also mentioned that. And so was this like kind of a doubling down by including it in this book?
Yeah, in a way it was me saying, no, these hold true. And I did extend the conversation a little bit between the two characters where, you know, Joan, the one who's the primary teacher who has been there for longer, really questions because Molly questions those categories and wants to believe she exists outside of those three categories. And Joan sort of takes her to task on that. And because I use Molly's response, which is, I also was looking for an adventure, is a common one I've heard. And I would still contend that if you're going to look for an adventure on someone else's remote traditional territory, you still should consider that you're one of those three categories.
So in this instance, you're the Joan character talking in response to these other people who, you know, resist those three categories and insist on kind of this is how I see things in visiting these communities or working in these communities.
Yes, absolutely. And I think that that was probably the one instance in the book where it was more of a meta writing for me, that I was well aware that I was speaking to other people, whereas, you know, you endeavor as an author to not have your characters just be mouthpieces for your ideas and have them be their own, you know, fully realized characters on their own, with their own thoughts that would be potentially different than mine. But that is the one instance where that was definitely me making a point.
When you're trying to resist being meta then and creating these characters who exist and aren't proving your point necessarily, how do you protect against that or like avoid that? Like, is there a purposeful nature to the writing when you're creating a character to kind of be like, how much of me is in this versus, you know, how much rings true to this character?
That's a good question. I think the only way I'm able to, maybe other writers are more adept at this than I am, but I think the only way to see through that and not have them just simply be your mouthpieces to the world is just through the process of editing. As you go through many, many edits, you start to recognize where it's you, not that character. And it's just a process of trying to see it from many different angles before you settle on one particular perspective that character has.
Now, as I mentioned, so Molly is essentially the central character. We, you know, get her viewpoint a lot of the time. The commentary, like in terms of her being a teacher, but she is an artist who is a visual artist rather than a written artist. Was there some thought to kind of like distance yourself from her by having her artistic milieu be something different than your own?
Well, actually, I would say in that case, it's still parallel to my own. And the idea for the manner in which she sketches her students, which is to distort their reality for her own sake, for her own sake of coping. She draws them in ways that shows them to be maybe more filled with hope than she always sees them to be, just simply more at times happier than they seem to be, at least in the classroom. And that actually stemmed from, because I do draw a lot. And when I was teaching in a remote community similar to Tewakan, I one day drew two of my students. And it occurred to me that I did draw them differently than I always see them. And it was just a moment of thinking, that was an interesting moment of reflection for me.
That active changing of kind of their outlook or how they present themselves that Molly does, I was curious about, because, you know, later on in the book, one of the things that becomes kind of very important is about whose story and how stories are told, and sort of the reflected versus refracted kind of nature of story. And it seems to me like Molly's doing sort of the same thing that someone who proves to be kind of much more malicious later on in the book is doing, but just kind of in a like less conscious way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think that's why a lot of people who have commented on the book so far in terms of reviews have noticed that a big part of the book is about the limits of good intentions, and, you know, where she has good intentions, what she needs to learn is that, and she learns this from the women in the community, really, to just that it's okay to see the students for who they are and what they bring to the classroom, and to meet them where they are, and to not try and see things in a distorted way. And so really, this is a book about her needing to learn how to see.
Now, is that based on like your own journey as an educator?
Oh, I think so. Absolutely. I think that, you know, even if you come with a self-awareness that you should be meeting the kids where they're at, it's very easy to get caught up in what you want for them, which is really just a projection of yourself, not of them. And it reminds me of, there is a section in The Heaviness of Things That Float where an elder warns the main character in that book to not fully assume to know, to endeavor to know the other, but don't assume to know the other because you might mistake their truths for yours or your truths for theirs, however you wish to word that. But I think that that's always the battle you are dealing with as an outsider is whose truths are you projecting here, yours or theirs?
Right. And that is something that kind of comes into conflict multiple times throughout the book. Is that something that you were wrestling with as like just an educator, as a person in a community in which, you know, it's not your historical culture? Like, is that something that you were processing and then attempting to kind of process through this novelization?
I don't think I was trying to process it through the novel. Because I'd already, I think, come to terms with it myself. And by come to terms, I just mean that I came to realize there's no end to the wrestling. It's always going to be there. And, you know, for example, to complicate that, you know, wrestling that an outsider might feel, it's further complicated by communities like that, their perception of formal education, and there's a real, they're wrestling themselves with it. You know, you have in those communities parents who are very well intending and they profess the importance of education for their kids, but at the same time, there's a lot that comes into conflict with that, and a lot of good things that come into conflict with that, like the desire to have more and more tradition and culture in the curriculum, in the school. And so notions of what success means to me as an outsider, non-First Nations teacher is going to be often at odds with what the community, what the parents perceive successful to mean. So it's, I don't foresee any resolution in my mind or in a larger sense in, you know, in that conflict.
Right. Now, one question I had about the book and just the notion of time. And so you have Molly being very new to this community. And so that obviously introduces, you know, this outsider who's kind of like learning the dynamics and the customs of this community. But the action, let's say, of the book takes place in a fairly brief period of time. Was that something you were conscious of when you were writing, like that this should happen in a short period of time? So it's this like flurry of activity, or did you give thought to kind of like how long it would take for this to unfold for Molly?
Yeah, no, it was purposely done that it was within a very short time frame. And the interesting moment I had with my editor, so my editor's sitting in Toronto, not having been to a community like that, not having those kinds of experiences. And early on in the editing, she said, this is not believable that she's already, after a month, for instance, so disheartened and so hopeless. And, you know, I said, well, we can talk about how I managed to convince the reader or not of that. But the fact is, that is reality. I've watched so many new teachers come to places like that, and they're falling apart in tears, whatever. They cannot believe the challenges they're facing in a small community, compounded with their own feeling of isolation, in such a short period of time. And so it is one of those kinds of jobs and kinds of places where a month goes by and you cannot believe the number of things, both good and bad. Everything's amplified and everything is in a flurry in those kind of places.
Well, as you have Molly say in one portion, like there's no off there because it's such a small community. She's never like away from things or switched off. She's always the teacher and she's always kind of like within the community in which she teaches, right? That forces things to be kind of more volatile, or at least like, you know, just it puts the pressure on a lot longer.
It certainly increases the intensity, yeah, for sure. I mean, I you know, you would go as a teacher in those places. I've experienced like going to a community dinner that should be my time off. It's, you know, 7 o'clock at night. And if there's issues with kids being, you know, too rambunctious in the community hall, you know, suddenly you're called upon by other parents to be the teacher and, you know, deal with that, even though you're not at work at that time. Like it is exactly that. You're never not the teacher in a place like that, which can be very overwhelming very quickly for people who go to work in those places as a brand new teacher, especially.
Right. Now, the book itself contains references to a lot of other books, and I'm very curious about kind of the decision to situate this in a real world of literature and to draw on those other pieces within your book. You know, you have Alice Munro stories, you have The Giving Tree. There's lots of references throughout. Was that like an intentional thing, or is that just in terms of trying to build like a believable world of education, story enters into education, and so you're drawing from existing story?
I think that at first that just came from, you know, my interests personally. You know, obviously as a writer, I'm a big reader. So, and as a teacher, having taught both elementary and high school, you know, I very much value story in the classroom. And so that comes out of just my inclinations. But as I was writing it, it occurred to me that this is actually a valuable part of the book because it's yet another layer. I mean, really, this book is about story and who has the power to tell a story and what harm story can do and what good story can do and what role story takes in different cultures. And so it just added another layer to, you know, story upon story, so to speak.
Did you have any misgivings, or I don't want to say misgivings, but like hesitation around, you know, drawing on existing works rather than like creating fictional works within your fiction to lean on? Like, was there any thought to that?
No, I mean, the connection of story. Stories are referred to, story in general, as it's discussed in the novel. That, I mean, story is, to me, intricately connected with our belief and our choices. And that was a big part of the novel. So if it's one thing to go up to somebody on the street and say, get a job, but if they don't believe they can do that, if they don't believe that's a choice they have to them, telling them so will not create a belief. So the idea, a big idea behind the book is what creates a belief in choice in people is story. Stories have that power. And so I wanted to refer to, like you mentioned, The Giving Tree. Those stories exist in the world that we can be using to help shape young people's beliefs in themselves and in their choices.
The central children, like there's kind of essentially three focused children, let's say. The decision to have three and to like have their specific backgrounds and then Molly's relationship with the three of them, did you give some thought, like were there other children in the classroom that you had initially maybe spent more time with or thought about, or was it always these three and always kind of like what happens to each of them and how it impacts Molly that was central to this story?
Well, I mean, there's, you know, the magic rule of three. So I chose three intentionally because I think that that is a, you know, a tried and true approach to storytelling, that there be three of anything. In terms of using these three children, I mean, if you look at their obviously the things they suffer from in the story is a crucial plot point. But I was more interested actually in choosing these three to choose their three talents that come out, because it was really important to me to show that, you know, amongst the challenges of among First Nations youth, there is incredible brilliance right now, and talent and ambition. And so I purposely chose, you know, one is an exceptional writer whose voice will one day turn the nation inside out. One is an exceptional artist, and one is an exceptional traditional dancer. So it was more that I wanted those three different talents to be highlighted in the novel.
Was it always apparent which one had which talent?
No. Well, yes, because they do connect to how they cope with the particular thing they suffer with. One writes to a mother who, the mother's not actually writing back. She writes her own letters from her mother back to her. So it made sense that she was the brilliant writer. And the other, who's the brilliant painter, the painting, which I won't explain because it's a spoiler alert, but the painting factors into it. And I knew that I wanted the most troubled character, Hannah, to be the amazing dancer. And that's because it allowed me to not have her talent be up front from the start, because she doesn't dance until the end of the book.
So holding back that talent is a purposeful thing to
Yeah.
sh show the concern and the worry about, you know, her troubled nature, and not necessarily giving a glimpse of what else she possesses.
Yes, and also that she's the unique one of the three for many reasons, but her talent's different than the others, because the others, the two others, their talents fit nicely into mainstream society, whereas Hannah's talent as a traditional dancer is contained within her culture. So I wanted to show that still alone is what will give her a sense of purpose within her community.
That, and I guess the visual and the written are more apparent to a teacher within the classroom context, right? That she can see the promise where she doesn't necessarily see it with Hannah.
Exactly.
You'd mentioned, you know, the sort of supernatural element to this story. Was that always there, or was that something that you wrestled with whether that should be included, making this, you know, a bit less straightforward?
It wasn't in my original drafts. And part of it came up because I struggled with many, many versions of this book, and it just wasn't working for me, no matter how much I tried over the years. And it was because I finally realized one day, I'm writing this as if it's an essay cleverly disguised as a story. And so I scrapped the whole thing and started and said, just tell a story. And I guess that freed me up to think of the more fantastical supernatural things. I also at that time had an experience where, you know, it was told to me that, as it is in the book, that Sasquatches do tend to do trickster-like things, like leaving giant boulders on top of tree stumps. And I was driving home from such a community one recently, like in the past few years. And as I was driving along a very remote logging road, I suddenly got a strange feeling, and I looked over into the woods, and there was a rock about the size of a fridge on top of a tree stump that was probably about 5'10" high, and it was just sitting there. And that sparked the notion that there, we don't know what is contained in this world, especially in places that feel very unlike what you know, as an outsider, what we are used to.
Right. So you'd heard the story about Sasquatches doing these kinds of things before seeing this stone?
Oh, yeah.
Right. So knowing that in mind, that put that into the book then in some sense?
Mm-hmm. Yes, exactly.
So you've done two stories set in Tewakan now. Like, is this a place that you think you'll return to, or is there something, you know, like specific about these two stories that just needed to be set there, and maybe you'll go further afield or somewhere else for future works? Do you have a thought about that?
Oh yes. No, these are the two books set there. I will not return. I've said what I've needed to say. And, you know, basically the first book was about belonging and being careful not to perceive yourself as belonging there more than you actually do. And this one was about hope and not, you know, projecting your own truths onto others when you are an outsider. So between those two things, I feel I've exhausted everything I feel I want to say.
Sure enough. Well, The Morning Bell Brings the Brokenhearted is available now. Jennifer Manuel, thanks very much for taking some time to talk about the book.
Thank you very much.